Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Snow Falling on Cedars by David Guterson, narrated by George Guidel. This work is copyrighted 1995 by David Guterson. This recording is copyrighted 1996 by Recorded Books Incorporated. San Pedro Island, north of Puget Sound, is a place so isolated that no one who lives there can afford to make enemies. But in 1954, a local fisherman is found suspiciously drowned, and a Japanese-American named Kabuo Miyamoto is charged with his murder. And now, Snow Falling on Cedars.
In the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. Ah, how hard a thing it is to tell what a wild and rough and stubborn wood this was, which in my thought renews the fear. Dante, The Divine Comedy. Harmony, like a following breeze at sea, is the exception. Harvey Oxenhorn, Tuning the Rig. Chapter 1. The accused man, Kabuo Miyamoto, sat proudly upright with a rigid grace, his palms placed softly on the defendant's table. The posture of a man who has detached himself, insofar as this is possible, at his own trial. Some in the gallery would later say that his stillness suggested a disdain for the proceedings. Others felt certain it veiled a fear of the verdict that was to come. Whichever it was, Kabuo showed nothing, not even a flicker of the eyes. He was dressed in a white shirt worn buttoned to the throat, and gray neatly pressed trousers. His figure, especially the neck and shoulders, communicated the impression of irrefutable physical strength and of precise, even imperial, bearing. Kabuo's features were smooth and angular. His hair had been cropped close to his skull in a manner that made its musculature prominent. In the face of the charge that had been leveled against him, he sat with his dark eyes trained straight ahead and did not appear moved at all. In the public gallery, every seat had been taken, yet the courtroom suggested nothing of the carnival atmosphere sometimes found at county murder trials. In fact, the 85 citizens gathered there seemed strangely subdued and contemplative. Most of them had known Carl Heine, a salmon gillnetter with a wife and three children, who was buried now in the Lutheran cemetery up on Indian Knob Hill. Most had dressed with the same communal propriety they felt on Sundays before attending church services. And since the courtroom, however stark, mirrored in their hearts the dignity of their prayer houses, they conducted themselves with church-going solemnity. This courtroom, Judge Llewellyn Fielding's, down at the end of a damp, drafty hallway on the third floor of the Island County Courthouse, was run down and small as courtrooms go. It was a place of gray-hued and bleak simplicity, a cramped gallery, a bench for the judge, a witness stand, a plywood platform for the jurors, and scuffed tables for the defendant and his prosecutor. The jurors sat with studiously impassive faces as they strained to make sense of matters. The men, two truck farmers, a retired crabber, a bookkeeper, a carpenter, a boat builder, a grocer, and a halibut schooner deckhand were all dressed in coats and neckties. The women all wore Sunday dresses. A retired waitress, a sawmill secretary, two nervous fisherwives, A hairdresser accompanied them as alternate. The bailiff, Ed Soames, at the request of Judge Fielding, had given a good head of steam to the sluggish radiators which now and again sighed in the four corners of the room. In the heat they produced, a humid, overbearing swelter, the smell of sour mildew seemed to rise from everything. Snow fell that morning outside the courthouse windows. Four tall, narrow arches of leaded glass that yielded a great quantity of weak December light. A wind from the sea lofted snowflakes against the window panes, where they melted and ran toward the casements. Beyond the courthouse, the town of Amity Harbor spread along the island shoreline. A few wind-whipped and decrepit Victorian mansions, remnants of a lost era of seagoing optimism, loomed out of the snowfall on the town's sporadic hills. Beyond them, cedars wove a steep mat of still green. The snow blurred from vision the clean contours of these cedar hills. The sea wind drove snowflakes steadily inland, hurling them against the fragrant trees, and the snow began to settle on the highest branches with a gentle implacability. The accused man, with one segment of his consciousness, watched the falling snow outside the windows. He had been exiled in the county jail for 77 days. The last part of September, all of October and all of November, the first week of December, in jail. There was no window anywhere in his basement cell, no portal through which the autumn light could come to him. He had missed autumn, he realized now. It had passed already, evaporated. The snowfall, which he witnessed out of the corners of his eyes, furious wind-whipped flakes against the windows, struck him as infinitely beautiful. San Pietro was an island of 5,000 damp souls, named by lost Spaniards who moored offshore in the year 1603. They'd sailed in search of the Northwest Passage, as many Spaniards did in those days, and their pilot and captain, Martin de Aguilar of the Vizcaíno expedition, sent a work detail ashore to cull a fresh spar pole from among the hemlocks at water's edge. Its members were murdered almost immediately upon setting foot on the beach by a party of Nootka slave raiders. Settlers arrived, mostly wayward souls and eccentrics who had meandered off the Oregon Trail. A few rooting pigs were slaughtered in 1845 by Canadian Englishmen up in arms about the border, but San Pedro Island generally lay clear of violence after that. The most distressing news story of the preceding 10 years had been the wounding of an island resident by a drunken Seattle yachtsman with a shotgun on the 4th of July, 1951. Amity Harbor, the island's only town, provided deep moorage for a fleet of purse seiners and one-man gill-netting boats. It was an eccentric, rainy, wind-beaten sea village, downtrodden and mildewed, the boards of its buildings bleached and weathered, their drain pipes rusted a dull orange. Its long, steep inclines lay broad and desolate. Its high-curbed gutters swarmed most winter nights with traveling rain. Often the sea wind made its single traffic light flail from side to side or caused the town's electrical power to flicker out and stay out for days. Main Street presented to the populace Peterson's Grocery, a post office, Fisk's Hardware Center, Larson's Pharmacy, a dime store with fountain owned by a woman in Seattle, a Puget Power office, a chandlery, Lottie Opsvig's apparel shop, Klaus Hartmann's real estate agency, the San Pedro Café, the Amity Harbor restaurant, and a battered run-down filling station owned and operated by the Torgerson brothers. At the wharf, a fish-packing plant exuded the odor of salmon bones. and the creosoted pilings at the state ferry terminal lay in among a fleet of mildewed boats. Rain, the spirit of the place, patiently beat down everything man-made. On winter evenings it roared in sheets against the pavements and made Amity Harbor invisible. San Pedro had, too, a brand of verdant beauty that inclined its residents toward the poetical. Enormous hills, soft green with cedars, rose and fell in every direction. The island homes were damp and moss-covered, and lay in solitary fields and vales of alfalfa, feed corn, and strawberries. Haphazard cedar fences lined the careless roads, which slid beneath the shadows of the trees and past the bracken meadows. Cows grazed, stinking of sweet dung and addled by summer blackflies. Here and there an islander tried his hand at milling saw logs on his own, leaving fragrant heaps of sawdust and mounds of cedar bark at roadside. The beaches glistened with smooth stones and seafoam. 2 dozen coves and inlets, each with its pleasant muddle of sailboats and summer homes, ran the circumference of San Pedro, an endless series of pristine anchorages. Inside Amity Harbor's courthouse, opposite the courtroom's 4 tall windows, a table had been set up to accommodate the influx of newspaper men to the island. The out-of-town reporters, 1 each from Bellingham, Anacortes, and Victoria, and 3 from the Seattle papers, exhibited no trace of the solemnity evident among the respectful citizens in the gallery. They slumped in their chairs, rested their chins in their hands, and whispered together conspiratorially. With their backs only a foot from a steam radiator, the out-of-town reporters were sweating. Ishmael Chambers, the local reporter, found that he was sweating too. He was a man of 31 with a hardened face, a tall man with the eyes of a war veteran. He had only 1 arm, the left having been amputated 10 inches below the shoulder joint, so that he wore the sleeve of his coat pinned up with the cuff fastened to the elbow. Ishmael understood that an air of disdain, of contempt for the island and its inhabitants, blew from the knot of out-of-town reporters toward the citizens in the gallery. Their discourse went forward in a miasma of sweat and heat that suggested a kind of indolence. 3 of them had loosened their ties just slightly. 2 others had removed their jackets. They were reporters, professionally jaded and professionally immune, a little too well-traveled in the last analysis to exert themselves toward the formalities San Pedro demanded silently of mainlanders. Ishmael, a native, did not want to be like them. The accused man, Kabuo, was somebody he knew, somebody he'd gone to high school with, and he couldn't bring himself, like the other reporters, to remove his coat at Kabuo's murder trial. At 10 minutes before 9 that morning, Ishmael had spoken with the accused man's wife on the 2nd floor of the Island County Courthouse. She was seated on a hall bench with her back to an arched window just outside the assessor's office, which was closed, gathering herself, apparently. "Are you all right?" he'd said to her, but she'd responded by turning away from him. "Please," he'd said. "Please, Hatsue." She'd turned her eyes on his then. Ishmael would find later, long after the trial, that their darkness would beleaguer his memory of these days. He would remember how rigorously her hair had been woven into a black knot against the nape of her neck. She had not been exactly cold to him, not exactly hateful, but he'd felt her distance anyway. "Go away," she'd said in a whisper. And then for a moment she'd glared. He remained uncertain afterward what her eyes had meant. Punishment? Sorrow? Pain?
go away,"
repeated Hatsue Miyamoto. Then she'd turned her eyes once again from his. "Don't be like this," said Ishmael.
"Go away,"
she'd answered. "Hatsue," said Ishmael, "don't be like this."
"Go away,"
she'd said again. Now, in the courtroom, with sweat on his temples, Ishmael felt embarrassed to be sitting among the reporters and decided that after the morning's recess he would find a more anonymous seat in the gallery. In the meantime, he sat facing the wind-driven snowfall, which had already begun to mute the streets outside the courthouse windows. He hoped it would snow recklessly and bring to the island the impossible winter purity, so rare and precious, he remembered fondly from his youth. Chapter 2. The first witness called by the prosecutor that day was the county sheriff, Art Moran. On the morning Carl Heine died, September 16th, the sheriff was in the midst of an inventory at his office and had engaged the services of the new court stenographer, Mrs. Eleanor Doakes, who now sat primly below the judge's bench, recording everything with silent implacability, as an aide in this annual county-mandated endeavor. He and Mrs. Doakes had exchanged surprised glances when Abel Martinson, the sheriff's deputy, reported over the newly purchased radio set that Carl Heine's fishing boat, the Susan Marie, had been sighted adrift in White Sand Bay. "Abel said the net was all run out and drifting along behind," Art Moran explained. "I felt, well, concerned immediately." "The Susan Marie was on the move?" asked Alvin Hooks, the prosecutor, who stood with one foot perched on the witness's podium as if he and Art were talking by a park bench. "That's what Abel said." "With its fishing lights on, is that what Deputy Martinson reported?"
"That's right."
"In daylight?"
"Abel called in 9:30 a.m., I believe."
"Correct me if I'm wrong," Alvin Hooks asked. "Gill nets, by law, must be on board by 9 o'clock. Is that right, Sheriff Moran?"
"That's correct," said the sheriff. 9 a.m.
The prosecutor swiveled with a faintly military flourish and executed a tight circle over the courtroom's waxed floor, his hands against the small of his back neatly.
"What did you do then?" he inquired.
"I told Abel to stay put, to stay where he was, that I would pick him up in the launch."
"You didn't call the Coast Guard?"
"Decided I'd hold off just yet. Decided to have a look myself."
Alvin Hooks nodded.
"Was it your jurisdiction, Sheriff?"
"It's a judgment call, Mr. Hooks," Art Moran said. "I felt it was the right thing to do."
The prosecutor nodded one more time and surveyed the members of the jury. He appreciated the sheriff's answer. It cast a favorable moral light on his witness and gave him the authority of the conscientious man, for which there was ultimately no substitute.
"Just tell the court your whole story," Alvin Hooks said, "the morning of September 16th.
The sheriff stared at him doubtfully for a moment. By nature, Art Moran was an uneasy person, nervous in the face of even trivial encounters. He'd come to his vocation as if driven ineluctably. He had never formed the intention of being sheriff, yet to his astonishment here he was, in his liver-colored uniform, black tie, and polished shoes. He looked inevitably miscast in life, a man uncomfortable with the accoutrements of his profession, as if he had dressed for a costume party and now wandered about in the disguise. The sheriff was a lean figure, unimposing, who habitually chewed a stick of juicy fruit gum, though he wasn't chewing any at the moment, mostly out of deference to the American legal system, which he believed in wholeheartedly despite its flaws. He'd lost much of his hair since turning 50, and his belly, always undernourished in appearance, now suggested a shriveled emaciation. Art Moran had lain awake the night before, fretting about his role in this trial, and remembering the sequence of events with his eyes shut, as if they were occurring in a dream. He and his deputy, Abel Martinson, had taken the county launch into White Sand Bay on the morning of September 16th. The tide, steadily on the rise, had turned about 3.5 hours before at 6:30. By mid-morning, sunlight lay like a glaze over the water, warming his back pleasantly. The preceding night, a fog as palpable as cotton had hung suspended over Island County. Later, it gently separated at the seams and became vast billows traveling above the sea instead of a still white miasma. Around the launch, as it churned toward the Susan Marie, the last remnants of this night fog sailed and drifted in shreds of vapor toward the sun's heat. Abel Martinson, one hand on the launch's throttle, the other on his knee, told Art that a Port Jensen fisherman, Eric Sivertson, Eric the Younger, he pointed out, had come across the Susan Marie adrift off the south side of White Sand Point, with her net set and, it appeared, no one on board. It was more than an hour and a half past dawn, and the running lights had been left on. Abel had driven to White Sand Point and walked out to the end of the community pier with his binoculars dangling from his neck. Sure enough, the Susan Marie lay drifting on the tide well into the bay on an angle north by northwest, he'd found, and so he'd radioed the sheriff. In 15 minutes they came abreast of the drifting boat, and Abel turned back the throttle. In the calm of the bay, their approach went smoothly. Art set the fenders out, and the two of them made fast their mooring lines with a few wraps each around the forward deck cleats. "Lights are all on," observed Art, one foot on the Susan Marie's gunwale. "Every last one of 'em looks like."
"He ain't here," replied Abel.
"Doesn't look like it," said Art.
"Went over," Abel said. "I got this bad feeling."
Art winced at hearing this.
"Let's hope not," he urged. "Don't say that."
He made his way just abaft of the cabin, then stood squinting up at the Susan Marie's guys and stays and at the peaks of her stabilizer bars. The red and white mast lights had been left on all morning. The picking light and the jack light at the end of the net both shone dully in the early sun. While Art stood there pondering this, Abel Martinson dragged the hatch cover from the hold and called for him to come over.
"You got something?" Art asked. "Look here," answered Abel.
Together they crouched over the square hold opening, out of which the odor of salmon flew up at them. Abel maneuvered his flashlight beam across a heap of inert, silent fish.
"Silvers," he said. "Maybe 50 of 'em."
"So he picked his net least once," said Art.
"Looks like it," answered Abel.
Men had been known to fall into empty holds before, crack their heads, and pass out even in calm weather. Art had heard of a few such incidents. He looked in at the fish again.
"What time you figure he put out last night?"
"Hard to say. 4:30, 5.
"Where'd he go, you figure?"
"Probably up North Bank," said Abel. "Maybe Ship Channel or Elliot Head. That's where the fish been running." But Art already knew about these things. San Pedro lived and breathed by the salmon, and the cryptic places where they ran at night were the subject of perpetual conversation. It had helped him to hear it aloud just now. It helped him to think more clearly. The two of them crouched by the hold a moment longer in a shared hiatus from their work. The still heap of salmon troubled Art in a way he couldn't readily articulate, and so he looked at it wordlessly. Then he rose, his knees creaking, and turned away from the dark hold.
"Let's keep looking," he suggested.
"Right," said Abel. "Could be he's up in his cabin, maybe. Knocked out one way or t'other." The Susan Marie was a 30-foot stern picker, a standard, well-tended San Pedro gillnetter, with her cabin just abaft of midship. Art ducked through its stern side entry and stood to port for a moment. In the middle of the floor, it was the first thing he noticed, a tin coffee cup lay tipped on its side. A marine battery lay just right of the wheel. There was a short bunk made up with a wool blanket to starboard. Abel ran his flashlight across it. The cabin lamp over the ship's wheel had been left on. A ripple of sunlight flaring through a window shimmered on the starboard wall. The scene left Art with the ominous impression of an extreme, too silent tidiness. A cased sausage hanging from a wire above the binnacle swayed a little as the Susan Marie undulated. Otherwise, nothing moved. No sound could be heard except now and again a dim, far crackle from the radio set. Art, noting it, began to manipulate the radio dials for no other reason than that he didn't know what else to do. He was at a loss. "This is bad," said Abel. "Take a look," answered Art. "I forgot. See if his dinghy's over the reel." Abel Martinson stuck his head out the entry. "It's there, Art," he said. "Now what?" For a moment they stared at one another. Then Art, with a sigh, sat down on the edge of Carl Heine's short bunk. "Maybe he crawled in under the decking," suggested Abel. "Maybe he had some kind of engine trouble, Art." "I'm sitting on top of his engine," Art pointed out. "There's no room for anyone to crawl around down there." "He went over," said Abel, shaking his head. "Looks like it," answered the sheriff. They glanced at each other, then away again. "Maybe somebody took him off," suggested Abel. "He got hurt, radioed. Somebody took him off. That they wouldn't let the boat drift," put in Art. "Besides, we'd have heard about it by now." "This is bad," repeated Abel Martinson. Art tucked another stick of juicy fruit between his teeth and wished this was not his responsibility. He liked Carl Heine, knew Carl's family, went to church with them on Sundays. Carl came from old-time island stock. His grandfather, Bavarian-born, had established 30 acres of strawberry fields on prime growing land in Center Valley. His father, too, had been a strawberry farmer before dying of a stroke in 1944. Then Carl's mother, Etta Heine, had sold all 30 acres to the Jurgensen clan while her son was away at the war. They were hard-toiling, quiet people, the Heines. Most people on San Pedro liked them. Carl, Art recalled, had served as a gunner on the USS Canton, which went down during the invasion of Okinawa. He'd survived the war, other island boys hadn't, and come home to a gillnetter's life. On the sea, Carl's blonde hair had gone russet-colored. He weighed 235 pounds, much of it carried in his chest and shoulders. On winter days, picking fish from his net, he wore a wool cap knitted by his wife and an infantryman's battered field jacket. He spent no time at the San Pedro Tavern or drinking coffee at the San Pedro Café. On Sunday mornings he sat with his wife and children in a back pew of the First Hill Lutheran Church, blinking slowly in the pale sanctuary light, a hymn book open in his large, square hands, a calm expression on his face. Sunday afternoons he squatted on the aft deck of his boat, silently and methodically untangling his gillnet or knitting its flaws up patiently. He worked alone. He was courteous but not friendly. He wore rubber boots almost everywhere, like all San Pedro fishermen. His wife, too, came from old island people, the Varigs, Art remembered, hay farmers and shake cutters with a few stump acres on Cattle Point, and her father had passed away not so long ago. Carl had named his boat after his wife and, in 1948, built a big frame house just west of Amity Harbor, including an apartment for his mother, Etta. But out of pride, word had it, Etta would not move in with him. She lived in town, a stout, grave woman with a slight Teutonic edge to her speech, over Lottie Opsvig's apparel shop on Main. Her son called at her door every Sunday afternoon and escorted her to his house for supper. Art had watched them trudge up Old Hill together, Etta with her umbrella turned against the winter rain, her free hand clutching at the lapels of a coarse winter coat, Carl with his hands curled up in his jacket pockets, his wool cap pulled to his eyebrows. All in all, Art decided, Carl Heine was a good man. He was silent, yes, and grave like his mother, but the war had a part in that, Art realized. Carl rarely laughed, but he did not seem, to Art's way of thinking, unhappy or dissatisfied. Now his death would land hard on San Pedro. No one would want to fathom its message in a place where so many made their living fishing. The fear of the sea that was always there, simmering beneath the surface of their island lives, would boil up in their hearts again. "Well, look," said Abel Martinson, leaning in the cabin door while the boat shifted about. "Let's get his net in, Art."
"Suppose we better," sighed Art. "All right, we better do it then, but we'll do it one step at a time."
"He's got a power takeoff back there," Abel Martinson pointed out. "You figure he hasn't run for maybe 6 hours, and all these lights been drawing off the battery. Better choke it up good, Art."
Art nodded and then turned the key beside the ship's wheel. The solenoid kicked in immediately. The engine stuttered once and then began to idle roughly, rattling frantically beneath the floorboards. Art slowly backed the choke off.
"Okay," he said. "Like that?" "Guess I was wrong," said Abel Martinson. "She sounds real good and strong."
They went out again, Art leading. The Susan Marie had veered off nearly perpendicular to the chop and angled briefly to starboard. With the thrust of the engine, she'd begun to bobble a little, and Art, treading across the aft deck, stumbled forward and grabbed at a stanchion, scraping his palm at the heel of the thumb while Abel Martinson looked on. He rose again, steadied himself with a foot on the starboard gunwale, and looked out across the water. The morning light had broadened, gained greater depth, and lay in a clean sheet across the bay, giving it a silver tincture. Not a boat was in sight except a single canoe traveling parallel to a tree-wreathed shoreline, children in life jackets at the flashing paddles a quarter mile off. "They're innocent," thought Art.
"It's good she's come about," he said to his deputy. "We'll need time to get this net in."
"Whenever you're ready," answered Abel.
For a moment it occurred to Art to explain certain matters to his deputy. Abel Martinson was 24, the son of an Anacortes brickmason. He had never seen a man brought up in a net before, as Art had, twice. It happened now and then to fishermen. They caught a hand or a sleeve in their net webbing and went over even in calm weather. It was a part of things, part of the fabric of the place. And as sheriff, he knew this well. He knew what bringing up the net really meant. And he knew Abel Martinson didn't. Now he put his foot on top of the beaver paddle and looked across at Abel.
"Get over there with the lead line," he said softly. "I'll bring her up real slow. You may need to pick some, so be ready."
Abel Martinson nodded. Art brought the weight of his foot down. The net shuddered for a moment as the slack went out of it, and then the reel wound it in against the weight of the sea. Surging and then lowering a note, the engine confronted its work. The two men stood at either end of the gunwale roller, Art with one shoe on the beaver paddle and Abel Martinson staring at the net webbing as it traveled slowly toward the drum. 10 yards out, the float line fell away and bobbled in a seam of white water along the surface of the bay. They were still moving up the tide about north by northwest, but the breeze from the south had shifted just enough to bring them gently to port. They had picked 2 dozen salmon from the net, 3 stray sticks, 2 dogfish, a long convoluted coil of kelp, and a number of ensnarled jellyfish, when Carl Heine's face showed. For a brief moment, Art understood Carl's face as the sort of illusion men are prone to at sea. or hoped it was this, rather, with a fleeting desperation. But then, as the net reeled in, Carl's bearded throat appeared, too, and the face completed itself. There was Carl's face, turned up toward the sunlight, and the water from Carl's hair dripped in silver strings to the sea. And now clearly it was Carl's face, his mouth open. Carl's face. And Art pressed harder against the beaver paddle. Up came Carl, hanging by the left buckle of his rubber bib overalls from the gill net he'd made his living picking. His T-shirt, bubbles of seawater coursing under it, pasted to his chest and shoulders. He hung heavily with his legs in the water, a salmon struggling in the net beside him, the skin of his collarbones, just above the highest waves, hued an icy but brilliant pink. He appeared to have been parboiled in the sea. Abel Martinson vomited. He leaned out over the transom of the boat, and retched and cleared his throat, and vomited again, this time more violently.
"All right, Abel," Art said. "You get a hold of yourself."
The deputy did not reply. He wiped his mouth with a handkerchief. He breathed heavily and spat into the sea a half dozen times. Then, after a moment, he dropped his head and pounded his left fist against the transom.
"Jesus Christ," he said.
"I'll bring him up slow," answered Art. "You keep his head back away from the transom, Abel. Get a hold of yourself. Keep his head back and away now."
But in the end, they had to rattle up the lead line and pull Carl fully into the folds of his net. They cupped the net around him like a kind of hammock so that his body was borne by the webbing. In this manner, they brought Carl Heine up from the sea, Abel yarding him over the net roller while Art tapped gingerly at the beaver paddle and squinted over the transom, his juicy fruit seized between his teeth. They laid him together on the afterdeck. In the cold salt water he had stiffened quickly. His right foot had frozen rigidly over his left, and his arms, locked at the shoulders, were fixed in place with the fingers curled. His mouth was open. His eyes were open, too, but the pupils had disappeared. Art saw how they'd revolved backward and now looked inward at his skull. The blood vessels in the whites of his eyes had burst. There were two crimson orbs in his head. Abel Martinson stared. Art found that he could not bring forward the least vestige of professionalism. He simply stood by, like his 24-year-old deputy, thinking the thoughts a man thinks at such a time about the ugly inevitability of death. There was a silence to be filled, and Art found himself hard-pressed in the face of it to conduct himself in a manner his deputy could learn from. And so they simply stood looking down at Carl's corpse, a thing that had silenced both of them. "He banged his head," whispered Abel Martinson, pointing to a wound Art hadn't noticed in Carl Heine's blonde hair. "Must have banged it against the gunwale going over." Sure enough, Carl Heine's skull had been crushed just above his left ear. The bone had fractured and left a dent in his head. Art Moran turned away from it. Chapter 3. Nels Goodmanson, the attorney who had been appointed to defend Kabuo Miyamoto, rose to cross-examine Art Moran with a slow and deliberate geriatric awkwardness. Then roughly cleared the phlegm from his throat and hooked his thumbs behind his suspenders where they met their tiny black catch buttons. At 79, Nels was blind in his left eye and could distinguish only shades of light and darkness through its transient, shadowy pupil. The right, however, as if to make up for this deficiency, seemed preternaturally observant, even prescient, and as he plodded over the courtroom floorboards, advancing with a limp toward Art Moran, motes of light winked through it.
Sheriff, he said. Good morning.
Good morning, replied Art Moran.
I just want to make sure I'm hearing you right on a couple of matters, said Nels. You say the lights on this boat, the Susan Marie, were all on. Is that right?
Yes, said the sheriff. They were.
In the cabin, too?
That's right.
The mast lights?
Yes.
The picking lights, the net lights, all of them?
Yes, sir, said Art Moran.
Thank you, Nell said. I thought that was what you said, all right, that they were all on, all the lights.
He paused, and for a moment seemed to study his hands, which were riddled with liver spots and trembled at times. Nels suffered from an advancing neurasthenia. Its foremost symptom was a sensation of heat that on occasion flamed in the nerve endings of his forehead until the arteries in his temples pulsed visibly.
"You say it was foggy on the night of September 15th?" Nels asked. "Is that what you said, Sheriff?"
"Yes."
"Thick fog?"
"Absolutely."
"Do you remember this?"
"I remember, yes. I've thought about it, because I went out on my porch about 10 o'clock, see? Hadn't seen fog for more than a week, and I couldn't see more than 20 yards.
"At 10 o'clock?"
"Yes."
"And then?"
"I went to bed, I guess."
"You went to bed. What time did you get up, Sheriff? Do you remember? On the 16th?
"I got up at 5 o'clock.
"You remember this?"
"I'm always up at 5 every morning, so on the 16th, yes, I was up at 5.
"And was the fog still there?"
"Yes, it was."
"Just as thick? As thick as at 10 o'clock the night before?"
"Almost, I'd say, almost, but not quite."
"So it was still foggy in the morning, then?"
"Yes, until 9 or so. Then it started burning off. Was mostly gone by the time we set out in the launch, if that's what you're driving at, sir."
"Until 9, answered Nels Goodmanson. "Or thereabouts, 9?
"That's right, replied Art Moran.
Nels Goodmanson raised his chin, fingered his bow tie, and pinched experimentally the wattles of skin at his neck, a habit of his when he was thinking.
"Out there on the Susan Marie," he said, "the engine started right up, Sheriff. When you went to start it, you had no trouble?"
"Right away," said Art Moran. "No trouble at all."
"With all those lights drawing, Sheriff, batteries still strong?"
"Must have been, because she started with no trouble."
"Did that strike you as odd, Sheriff? Do you remember? That with all those lights drawing, the battery still had plenty of charge, enough to turn the engine over with no trouble, as you say?"
"Didn't think about it at the time," said Art Moran. "So no was the answer. It didn't strike me as odd, at least not then."
"And does it strike you as odd now?"
"A little," said the sheriff. "Yes."
"Why?" Nels asked.
"Because those lights do a lot of drawing. I'd reckon they can run a battery down quick, just like in your car. So I have to wonder a little, yes."
"You have to wonder,"
said Nels Goodmanson, and he began to massage his throat again and pull at the dewlaps of skin there. Nels made his way to the evidence table, selected a folder, and brought it to Art Moran.
"Your investigative report," he said, "the one just admitted into evidence during Mr. Hooks's direct examination. Is this it, Sheriff?"
"It is."
"Could you turn to page 7, please?"
The sheriff did so.
"Now," said Nels, "is page 7 an inventory of items found on board Carl Heine's boat, the Susan Marie?"
"It is."
"Could you read for the court the item listed as number 27?
"Of course," said Art Moran. "Item 27, a spare D8 battery, 6-celled.
"A spare D8 battery, 6-celled, said Nels.
Thank you. A D8. 6-celled. Would you turn now to item 42, Sheriff, and read one more time for the court?
Item 42, replied Art Moran. D8 and D6 batteries in battery well, each 6-celled.
A 6 and an 8, Nels said.
Yes.
I did some measuring down at the Chandlery, said Nels. A D6 is wider than a D8 by an inch. It wouldn't fit into the Susan Marie's battery well, Sheriff. It was an inch too large for that.
He'd done some on-the-spot refitting, Art explained. The side flange was banged away to make room for a D6.
He banged out the side flange.
Yes.
You could see this?
Yes.
A metal flange that had been banged aside?
Yes.
Soft metal?
Yes, soft enough. It had been banged back to make room for a D6.
To make room for a D6, Nels repeated. But, Sheriff, didn't you say that the spare was a D8? Didn't Carl Heine have a D8 available that would have fit into the existing well with none of this banging and refitting?
The spare was dead, Art Moran said. We tested it after we brought the boat in. It didn't have any juice to it, Mr. Goodmanson. Didn't have any juice at all.
The spare was dead,
Nels repeated.
So, to summarize, you found on the deceased's boat a dead spare D8 battery, a working D8 down in the well, and beside it a working D6 that was, in fact, too large for the existing space and which forced someone to do some refitting, some banging at a soft metal flange.
All correct, said the sheriff.
All right now, said Nels Goodmanson. Would you please turn to page 27 of your report? Your inventory of items aboard the defendant's boat, and read for the court item 24, please.
Art Moran turned the pages. Item 24, he said after a while. 2 D6 batteries in well, each 6-celled.
2 D6s on Kabuo Miyamoto's boat, Nels said. And did you find a spare aboard, Sheriff?
No, we didn't. It isn't in the inventory.
The defendant had no spare battery aboard his boat? He'd gone out fishing without one?
Apparently, yes, sir, he did.
Well, then, Nels said. 2 D6s in the well, and no spare to be found. Tell me, Sheriff, these D6s on the defendant's boat, were they the same sort of D6 you found in the deceased's battery well on board the Susan Marie? The same size, the same make?
Yes, replied the sheriff. All D6s, the same battery.
So the D6 in use on the deceased's boat could have, hypothetically, since it was identical, made a perfect spare for the defendant's batteries.
I suppose so.
But as you say, the defendant had no spare on board, is that right?
Yes.
All right, Sheriff, Nels said. Let me ask you about something else, if you don't mind, for a moment. Tell me, when you brought the deceased in, was there some sort of trouble when you hauled him up from the sea in his fishing net?
Yes, said Art Moran. I mean, he was heavy, and, well, his lower half, his legs and feet, they wanted to slide out of the net. He was hanging by one of his rain gear buckles, and we were afraid if we pulled him out of the water, maybe we'd lose him altogether. He'd come out and the buckle would give, or the rubber around it would, and he'd be gone. His legs were hanging in the water, you understand? His legs weren't quite in the net.
And
said Nels Goodmanson. "Can you tell us what you and Deputy Martinson did about this?"
"Well, we cupped the webbing, and then we pulled on the lead line. We made a sort of cradle with the net, got his legs inside it, then we brought him in."
"So you had some trouble,"
Nels said.
"A little, yes." "He didn't come in cleanly?"
"Not at first, no. We had to jerk the net around, work it, but once we had him in and the webbing grabbed, it was fairly smooth from there, yes."
"Sheriff," said Nels Goodmanson, "with all of this jerking of the net and this trouble you're mentioning now, is it possible the deceased hid his head on the transom of the boat as you were bringing him in? Or somewhere else, on the stern gunwale, say, or on the net roller? Is it possible?"
"I don't think so," said Art Moran. "I would have seen it if we did."
"You don't think so," said Nels Goodmanson. "What about when you pulled him out of the net, when you laid him on the deck? He was a big man, as you say, 235 pounds, and stiff, as you've pointed out. Was he difficult to move around, Sheriff?"
"He was heavy, yes, real heavy, but there were two of us, and we were careful. We didn't hit him on anything."
"Are you sure of this?"
"I don't remember hitting him on anything. No, Mr. Goodmanson, we were careful, as I've said already."
"But you don't remember,"
Nels said.
"Or, to put it another way, do you have any uncertainty at all about this? That in moving this awkward and heavy corpse about, in operating this winch equipment you'd rarely operated before, in doing this difficult job of bringing in a drowned man of 235 pounds, is it possible, Sheriff Moran, that the deceased banged his head sometime after his death? Is that possible?"
"Yes," said Art Moran. "Possible, I guess it is, but not likely."
Nels Goodmanson turned toward the jury.
"No more questions," he said.
And with a slowness that embarrassed him, because as a young man he had been lithe and an athlete, had always moved fluidly across the floorboards of courtrooms, had always felt admired for his physical appearance, he made his way back to his seat at the defendant's table, where Kabuo Miyamoto sat, watching him. Chapter 4 Judge Lou Fielding called for a recess at 10:45 that first morning. He turned to observe the silent sweep of the snowfall, rubbed his graying eyebrows and the tip of his nose, then rose in his black robe, slid his hands through his hair, and lumbered into his chambers. The accused man, Kabuo Miyamoto, leaned to his right and nodded just perceptibly while Nels Goodmanson spoke into his ear. Across the aisle, Alvin Hooks rested his chin in his hands, drumming the floorboards with the heel of his shoe, impatient but not dissatisfied. In the gallery, the citizens stood and yawned, then wandered off into the less stultifying atmosphere of the hallway, or gazed out the windows with awed expressions, watching the snow lash toward them in parabolas before it struck against the leaded panes. Their faces, bathed in the attenuated December light from the tall windows, appeared quiet and even faintly reverent. Those who had driven into town felt fretful about getting home. The jurors were led away by Ed Soames to drink cone-shaped cups of lukewarm, cooler water and to make use of the lavatory. Then Soames reappeared and plodded about like a parish beetle backing down the steam radiator valves. Yet it remained too hot in the courtroom despite this. The trapped heat wouldn't dissipate. Steam began to coalesce in a film of vapor on the upper reaches of the windows, closing the courtroom in a little, muffling the pale morning light. Ishmael Chambers found a seat in the gallery and sat, tapping his pencil's eraser against his bottom lip. Like others on San Pedro Island, he'd first heard about the death of Carl Heine on the afternoon of September 16th, the day the body was discovered. He'd been calling the Reverend Gordon Groves of the Amity Harbor Lutheran congregation to ask about the sermon topic for Sunday in order that he might paraphrase the Reverend's answer in his At Our Island Churches column, a weekly feature in the San Pedro Review that ran beside the Anacortes ferry schedule. The Reverend Groves was not in, but his wife, Lillian, informed Ishmael that Carl Heine had drowned and been found tangled in his gill net. Ishmael Chambers did not believe her. Lillian Groves was a gossip. He was not inclined to believe such a thing, and when he hung up, sat, brooding over it. Then, disbelieving, he dialed the sheriff's office and asked Eleanor Doakes, a person he did not entirely trust either. "Yes," she replied, "Carl Heine had drowned. He'd been fishing, yes. He'd been found in his net. The sheriff? Not in just now." She supposed he was seeing the coroner. Ishmael immediately called the coroner, Horace Whaley. "That's right," said Horace. "You'd better believe it. Carl Heine was dead. Terrible thing, wasn't it? The man had survived Okinawa." Carl Heine. It was unbelievable. He'd hit his head on something. "The sheriff," said Horace, "you just barely missed him. He and Abel both just barely gone, heading for the docks, they said." Ishmael Chambers put down the receiver and sat with his forehead held in his palm, remembering Carl Heine from high school. They had both graduated in 42. They had played on the football team together. He remembered riding the team bus with Carl to a game against Bellingham in the fall of 41. They rode wearing their uniforms, their helmets in their laps, each boy carrying his own towel. He remembered how Carl looked, sitting beside him, with his gym towel draped around his thick German neck, glaring out the window at the fields. It was dusk, a brief November twilight, and Carl was watching snow geese land in low flooded wheat, his square chin set, his head tilted up, a man's blonde stubble on his jaw. "Chambers," he'd said, "you see the geese?" Ishmael slid a notepad into the pocket of his pants and went outside into Hill Street. Behind him, he left unlocked the office of the Review, three rooms that had once housed a book and magazine shop and still contained its many wall shelves. The bookshop had ultimately not been profitable because of the steep hill on which it was situated. Hill Street discouraged tourists. Ishmael, though, liked this feature of it. He had nothing in principle against the vacationers from Seattle, who frequented San Pedro all summer long. Most islanders disliked them because they were city people. But on the other hand, he did not especially enjoy seeing them as they wandered up and down Main Street. Tourists reminded him of other places and elicited in him a prodding doubt that living here was what he wanted. He had not always been so ambivalent about his home. Once he'd known how he felt about it. After the war, a man of 23 with an amputated arm, he'd left San Pedro without reluctance to attend school in Seattle. He'd lived in a boarding house on Brooklyn Avenue and taken, at first, history classes. He hadn't been particularly happy in this period, but in that regard he was like other veterans. He was keenly aware of his pinned-up sleeve and troubled because it troubled other people. Since they could not forget about it, neither could he. There were times when he visited taverns near campus and allowed himself to act gregarious and animated in the manner of younger students. Afterward, he inevitably felt foolish, however. It was not in him to drink beer and shoot pool. His more natural domain was a high-backed booth near the rear of Day's Restaurant on University Way, where he sipped coffee and read his history. The next fall, Ishmael took up American literature. Melville, Hawthorne, Twain. He was prepared, in his cynicism, to find Moby Dick unreadable. 500 pages about chasing a whale. But, as it turned out, it was entertaining.
He read the whole thing in 10 sittings in his booth a day's, and began pondering the whale's nature at an early juncture. The narrator, he found upon reading the first sentence, bore his own name, Ishmael. Ishmael was all right, but Ahab he could not respect, and this ultimately undermined the book for him. Huckleberry Finn he had read as a child, but he couldn't remember much of it. He recalled only that it was funnier then. Everything was funnier. But the story had fled his mind. Other people spoke fondly and knowingly of books they had read decades before. Ishmael suspected this was pretense. He sometimes wondered what had become of the books he'd read many years earlier, if they were still somewhere inside him. James Fenimore Cooper, Sir Walter Scott, Dickens, William Dean Howells. He didn't think any of them were still there. He couldn't remember them anyway. The Scarlet Letter he read in 6 sittings. He closed down days finishing it. The cook came out from behind the swinging doors and told him it was time to leave. Ishmael was on the last page when this occurred and ended up reading, "On a field, sable, the letter A, gules," while standing on the sidewalk outside. What did it mean? He could only guess what it might fully mean, even with the explanatory footnote. People hurried past him while he stood there with his book open, an October gust blowing in his face. He felt troubled by this ending to the story of Hester Prynne. The woman, after all, deserved better. All right, he decided, books were a good thing, but that was all they were and nothing else. They couldn't put food on his table. And so Ishmael turned to journalism. His father, Arthur, had been a logger at Ishmael's age. Wearing a handlebar mustache and calf-high caulk boots, frayed suspenders and woolen long johns, he'd labored in the service of the Port Jefferson Mill Company for 4.5 years. Ishmael's grandfather had been a Highland Presbyterian, his grandmother an Irish zealot from the bogs above Loch Ray. They met in Seattle 5 years before the Great Fire, wed, and raised 6 sons. Arthur, the youngest, was the only one to remain on Puget Sound. 2 of his brothers became mercenary soldiers. One died of malaria on the Panama Canal. One became a surveyor in Burma and India. And the last made tracks for the eastern seaboard at 17, never to be heard from again. The San Pedro Review, a 4-page weekly, was the invention of Arthur's early 20s. With his savings, he acquired a printing press, a box camera, and a damp, low-ceilinged office in the rear of a fish-processing warehouse. The inaugural edition of the review displayed a banner headline, "Jury Acquits Seattle's Gill." Brushing shoulders with reporters from The Star, The Times, The Evening Post, The Daily Call, and the Seattle Union-Record, Arthur had covered the trial of Mayor Hiram Gill, accused in a liquor scandal. He ran a long feature on George Vandeveer, charlatan attorney for the Wobbly defense in the Everett massacre deliberations. An editorial pleaded for the exercise of common sense as Wilson moved to declare war. Another celebrated the recent extension of ferry service to the leeward side of the island. A meeting of the Rhododendron Society was announced, as was an evening of square dancing at the Grange and the birth of a son, Theodore Ignatius, to the Horatio Marches of Cattle Point. All of this appeared in Centurion bold type, already antiquated in 1917, with delicate hairlines separating 7 columns and subheads in bold serif relief. Shortly thereafter, Arthur was drafted to serve in General Pershing's army. He fought at St. Mihiel in Belleau Wood, then came home to his newspaper. He married a Seattle woman of Illini stock, corn-blonde, svelte, and somber-eyed. Her father, a haberdasher on Seattle's First Avenue and a real estate speculator, frowned on Arthur, who seemed to him a lumberjack posing as a reporter, a man without prospects and unworthy of his daughter. Nevertheless, the two were married and settled down to the business of rearing children. They had only one, though, after much effort.
They lost a second at birth. They built a house at South Beach with a view of the sea and cleared a path to the beach. Arthur became an astute and deliberate vegetable gardener, an inveterate observer of island life, and gradually a small-town newspaper man in the truest sense. He came to recognize the opportunity his words provided for leverage, celebrity, and service. For many years, he took no vacations. He put out extra editions on Christmas Eve, during election week, and on the 4th of July. Ishmael remembered running the press with his father every Tuesday evening. Arthur had bolted it to the floor of a boat-building warehouse on Andreasen Street, a dilapidated barn that smelled permanently of lithographic ink and of the ammonia in the typesetting machine. The press was an enormous lime-green contraption, rollers and conveyor pulleys in a cast-iron housing. It started with the hesitancy of a 19th-century locomotive and shrieked and bleated while it ran. It was Ishmael's job to set the impression meters and water fountains and to act in the role of flyboy. Arthur, who had formed over the years a symbiotic relationship with the machine, ducked in and out inspecting the plates and printing cylinders. He stood mere inches from the clattering rollers, seemingly oblivious to the fact that, as he'd explained to his son, were he caught by a sleeve, he'd be instantly popped open like a child's balloon and splattered across the walls. Even his bones would disappear, this was part of Arthur's warning, until somebody found them scattered among the stained newsprint on the floor, looking like strips of white confetti. A group of businessmen from the Chamber of Commerce had tried to persuade Arthur to run for the Washington State Legislature. They came to the house dressed in overcoats and checkered scarves, reeking of pomade and shaving soap, and sat down to snifters of blackberry cordial, after which Arthur declined to run for office, telling the gentleman from Amity Harbor that he harbored no illusions, that he preferred to turn sentences and prune his mulberry hedges. The sleeves of his striped Oxford shirt lay rolled to his elbows so that the hairs on his forearms showed. His back formed a long, hard wedge of muscle against which his suspenders rode tautly. On his nose, a bit low, sat his steel-rimmed full moons, gently prosthetic and handsomely discordant with the sinewy length of his jawline. The cartilage in his nose was twisted. It had been broken by the lash of a wayward logging cable in the winter of 1915. The men from Amity Harbor couldn't argue with this or with the fixed upward tilt of his chin and jaw. They left unsatisfied. An unflagging loyalty to his profession and its principles had made Arthur over the years increasingly deliberate in his speech and actions, and increasingly exacting regarding the truth in even his most casual reportage. He was, his son remembered, morally meticulous. And though Ishmael might strive to emulate this, there was nevertheless this matter of the war, this matter of the arm he'd lost, that made such scrupulosity difficult. He had a chip on his shoulder. It was a sort of black joke he shared with himself, a double entendre made silently. He didn't like very many people anymore, or very many things, either. He preferred not to be this way, but there it was. He was like that. His cynicism, a veteran's cynicism, was a thing that disturbed him all the time. It seemed to him, after the war, that the world was thoroughly altered. It was not even a thing you could explain to anybody, why it was that everything was folly. People appeared enormously foolish to him. He understood that they were only animated cavities full of jelly and strings and liquids. He had seen the insides of jaggedly ripped-open dead people. He knew, for instance, what brains looked like spilling out of somebody's head. In the context of this, much of what went on in normal life seemed wholly and disturbingly ridiculous. He found that he was irritated with complete strangers. If somebody in one of his classes spoke to him, he answered stiffly, tersely.
He could never tell if they were relaxed enough about his arm to say what they were really thinking. He sensed their need to extend sympathy to him, and this irritated him even more. The arm was a grim enough thing without that, and he felt sure it was entirely disgusting. He could repel people if he chose by wearing to class a short-sleeved shirt that revealed the scar tissue on his stump. He never did this, however. He didn't exactly want to repel people. Anyway, he had this view of things, that most human activity was utter folly, his own included, and that his existence in the world made others nervous. He couldn't help but possess this unhappy perspective, no matter how much he might not want it. It was his, and he suffered from it, numbly. Later, when he was no longer so young and back home on San Pedro Island, this view of things began to moderate. He learned to be cordial to everyone, a sophisticated and ultimately false front. Add to the cynicism of a man wounded in war the inevitable cynicism of growing older and the professional cynicism of the journalist. Gradually, Ishmael came to view himself as a one-armed man with a pinned-up sleeve, past 30, and unmarried. It was not so bad, and he was not so irritated as he had once been in Seattle. Still, though, there were those tourists, he thought, as he walked down Hill Street toward the docks. All summer they looked at his pinned-up sleeve with the surprised, unaccustomed faces his fellow islanders had stopped making. And with their ice cream and clean faces, they elicited in his gut again that bilious, unwanted irritation. The strange thing was, he wanted to like everyone. He just couldn't find a way to do it. His mother, who was 56 and lived alone in the old family house on the south end of the island, the house where Ishmael had lived as a child, had pointed out to him when he'd come home from the city that this cynicism of his, while understandable, was, on the other hand, entirely unbecoming. His father before him had had it, she said, and it had been unbecoming in him, too. He loved humankind dearly, and with all his heart, but he disliked most human beings, she'd told Ishmael. You're the same, you know. You're your father's son.
This ends Disc 1.